This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will return next week. My special guest and co-host for the program is Dr. Deepa Kumar. Today's show, surrounding her area of expertise, Islamophobia and the politics of empire, from the national insecurity state to drone wars and beyond in the 21st century. We're joined by Dr. Arun Kundnani, author most recently of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. We'll discuss issues of media censorship and framing around these topics, plus resistance to Condoleezza Rice coming to Rutgers, the New York Police Department's targeted surveillance of Muslims, and more. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will return next week. My special guest and co-host for the program is Dr. Deepa Kumar. She is Associate Professor of Media Studies and Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University. She's the author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire and Outside the Box, Corporate Media Globalization and the UPS Strike. And Deepa, thank you so much for joining us today, both as a great guest and co-host with me this morning.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I can't say I've ever done this before, so I'm looking forward to this experience.
Absolutely, so am I. We're also joined by Dr. Arun Kundnani. He writes about race, Islamophobia, political violence, and surveillance. His latest book, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror, was published by Verso Books in March 2014, so that's just last month here. Born and bred in London, moved to New York in 2010 on a fellowship with the Open Society Foundation, lives in Harlem. He's the author also of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain, which was selected as a New Statesman's Book of the Year in 2007. Former editor of the journal Race and Class, he's educated at Cambridge, holds a PhD from London Metropolitan University, and teaches at New York University. Arun Kundnani, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So let's get started on the topic, something that both of you are obviously well steeped in. And the topic of the show, I, of course, riffed on the title of your book, Deepa, Islamophobia and Politics of Empire, and tacked on, of course, because we're going to talk about the national insecurity state, really. Drone wars, we'll talk about the New York Police Department, a lot of things on tap. We have the whole show to talk with you. So, Deepa, let's start with you, and let's talk about Islamophobia and general and the conference here at UC Berkeley Bolt Law School, and you'll be speaking there.
Yes, what brings me to sunny Berkeley is a conference that's organized yearly, actually, and this year's theme is Islamophobia, Latent and Manifest. And I think that's a good theme to explore because very often people recognized manifest Islamophobia. That is when you have far right-wing people saying the most racist and blatantly horrible things about Muslims. It's easy for people to identify, but very often when it's latent, when it's nuanced, when it takes a liberal form, people don't necessarily recognize it as a form of racism. So that's the theme that's being explored this year at the conference.
Mm-hmm. And Arun?
I'm kind of interested in the way in which this culture of Islamophobia that we have in the United States kind of legitimizes and organizes systems of surveillance. So we've had this debate over the last year or so with the Edward Snowden whistleblowing revelations that has given us some sense of what the National Security Agency is up to. But for me, that debate has actually become quite abstract and legalistic, and it doesn't really ask the question of who is actually experiencing surveillance in their everyday lives, right? And one of those major groups is Muslims in the United States. So I'm trying to talk about what is that experience of being targeted by the security state, what does that look like, and what are the ways in which that surveillance is actually legitimized by all kinds of ideas about, you know, Muslims and Islam.
And it also becomes part of the dominant cultural narrative, the idea that some groups are inherently dangerous and some groups, apparently, particularly post 9/11, need to be looked upon or watched, and it becomes very normalized, the idea that, well, some people don't really have the same rights as others.
Right, exactly. And if you listen to, if you listen to people like Keith Alexander, former head of the NSA, he keeps using this phrase, the bad guys, right? We only focus on the bad guys. We're not interested in average people, right? But when you actually unpick what are those phrases mean, the bad guys isn't actually people reasonably suspected of being involved in an actual terrorist plot. The bad guys is people who are being targeted because of their racial or religious background or because they're political activists.
Deepa Kumar, let's take a look at some specific instances, some specific events. I know something that you've written about and wanted to discuss was the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. And let's relate this subject to that. And what would you like to say about that?
Yeah, the Boston Marathon bombing occurred on April 15th. And if you think about how the initial suspicions were cast in terms of who was actually responsible for the bombing, immediately, of course, it was three brown people who were, you know, found to be guilty with no proof other than the fact that they were brown-skinned, and two of them actually were Moroccan and were at the Boston Marathon, but they happened to have backpacks on, and that seems to be enough to actually see them as being guilty. And Reddit, the social networking site, actually did this crowdsourcing experiment where they got hundreds and possibly thousands of users to you know, to look through some of the photos of the event itself to identify who might be responsible. And it's not a coincidence that the people that they target are brown-skinned, because there has been now about a 3 or 4 decade process by which not only politicians and the political spheres have associated terrorism with Arabs, with Muslims, and so on, but also in the news media and in the cultural sphere, there are dozens of films that actually present brown-skinned people, and particularly brown men, as these awful, you know, people just bent on destroying the United States and attacking Americans and so forth. So it's not a coincidence that even in the so-called post-racial society that we live in, that certain groups of people are seen as a suspect population.
That term post-racial is, I hear it quizzically, meaning you just clearly suggested that it's not exactly post-racial, although that seems to be the normalized ideal. And certainly in the United States with Barack Obama, right, we have the African-American president, and we're moving along here. But, you know, when we take a look at the demographics, the statistics, the prison populations, you know, the class rankings and so on, and do a race analysis over, this is a big part of America's history. And we haven't just zipped out of it because one of the elites happens to be African-American.
Absolutely. And it's not to say that, you know, manifest and blatant forms of racism don't exist. Of course they do. But part of the shift that you see in the Obama era is the use of liberal language, the use of multiculturalism, for instance, to bolster the national security state. This is the presentation I'm making today. I'm looking at the Department of Homeland Security's See Something, Say Something campaign. And what's so curious about it is that you see the heroes, the protagonists, are people of color. They're African-American, they're Asian, and so on, and the bad guys are white people. But if you look at the narrative behind it, it's always about some foreign ideology, something that's not American, that's coming and infesting our people. And the emphasis on homegrown terrorism, you know, has meant looking at each other suspiciously through the See Something, Say Something campaign. But I want to actually kick it over to Arun. You write about theories of radicalization in your book, in terms of how the security establishment actually look at who to target and who not to. Can you say a little bit about that?
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that's happened over the last 10 years is academics in what we now have a terrorism studies departments that have been created after 9/11 and have this kind of revolving door relationship with security agencies. These academics have actually developed what they call models of radicalization that claim to predict who's going to be a terrorist in the future, right, based on their behavioral indicators or something like that. And so those kind of models have become central to the way in which the war on terror now works, because the war on terror has adopted this, what it calls a kind of preventative framework, right? In other words, we're not just interested in actual terrorism, we're interested in the future, right? And people who aren't terrorists now, but who we think might be in the future, right? And when you put those kinds of policies into practice, what you're talking about is the mass surveillance of people for these behavioral indicators that you think have this predictive power. And those behavioural indicators are things like being involved in a Muslim community group, right? So they're actually about criminalising activities that are protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, right? And when you actually look at these academic models and try and subject them to any kind of analytical scrutiny, they don't stand up, you know, in any kind of rigorous way. But they've become hugely influential in the way that we think about counterterrorism.
So the NYPD has its own radicalization model. Can you speak a little bit about that? And also the recent lawsuit that was brought by New Jersey Muslims against surveillance, the NYPD with training from the CIA, set up what they called a demographics unit, which recently was disbanded. But nevertheless, since 2002, what they have done is they instituted what they called a human mapping program, where they sent infiltrators into Muslim mosques, into businesses, into universities and campus groups, and even elementary schools, right, in order to collect information about the suspect population. So can you say a little bit about this program, as well as the NYPD's own theory of radicalization, and finally the decision by the New Jersey judge to actually throw out this lawsuit?
Right. So around about 2006, a couple of academics actually worked with the New York Police Department to develop what it calls its radicalization model, right? Which basically says, there's four stages that you can go through on the way to becoming a terrorist. Stage two includes things like growing a beard, wearing traditional Islamic clothing. Yeah, a few of us in this room are already in trouble.
In trouble.
Right there. So those were considered signals that someone is radicalizing, right? And so then once you have that model in place, you set up a system of surveillance where you want to know in every mosque in New York, in every community organization in New York, in every cafe where you think Muslims spend time, you want to be able to know, are these signals of radicalization appearing? And what are the kind of political opinions that people have? What are the religious opinions that people have? This is all the kinds of data that was being collected by this so-called demographics unit. The South Asian and Arab restaurant business in New York has effectively been subsidized by the New York Police Department over the last decade because so many informants were going in and having meals and writing down, you know, what people were talking about. One of the things that happened in 2011 is the Associated Press did a series of stories on this program. One of the things that came out was this program with, you know, millions of dollars and a very large number of undercover agents never produced a single criminal lead, right? What it did was generate a whole load of information about people's political opinions and their religious behaviors, right? So there's been a strong campaign in New York from Muslims to say this kind of surveillance violates the civil rights of that community, and that fed into the mayoral campaign last year. And so one of the consequences of that has been the announcement this week that particular demographics unit has been disbanded. We still have an intelligence division within the New York Police Department that has a whole load of tactics and techniques at its disposal that are incredibly dangerous. We're going to continue to see the systematic surveillance of Muslims in New York in these ways.
We're speaking with Dr. Arun Kundnani. His recent book, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror, that's out by Verso Books. Also joined by guest co-host, Dr. Deepa Kumar, author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. That's by Haymarket Books. Let's go back to this. So the NYPD, Deepa, we can go with you if you'd like. So the NYPD has claimed then just recently that they have ceased the program or dismantled the program. But for some reason, I don't feel so convinced by that. And you?
Well, you know, as Arun was saying earlier, there certainly are other aspects of this program that are likely to continue. I mean, the fact of the matter is that when you have a notion of Muslim Americans as being a suspect population, you may dismantle one or the other way of collecting information on them. But the way in which you look at this population is going to necessitate new forms of surveillance. And so, you know, as Arun said earlier, the current mayor actually ran a pretty populist campaign. He spoke out against racial profiling, both as it impacts African-Americans and Latinos in the Stop and Frisk program. And then he also spoke out about the surveillance of Muslim Americans. And so we are starting to see small gestures being made towards the group that actually, the groups that actually place their faith in them. But I'm not convinced that the entire system whereby Muslims are seen as suspicious is going to necessarily be dismantled. But Arun, as you were saying earlier, I mean, this approach to Muslim Americans is very much like the Steven Spielberg film Minority Report, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have these precog units that can predict what somebody is actually going to do. And now we see that in reality in the form of these radicalization programs.
It's Orwellian thought crime, right? And then there's this matrix that allegedly this data that is compiled and these algorithms are put together and mysteriously we find the guilty parties, which not coincidentally then match up to our preconceived notions that Deepa was talking about earlier that have been sort of ingrained in American culture about who the other is and who should be suspect.
Right. I mean, in a racist society, those kinds of data-based surveillance are always going to reflect the racism in society, right? So it's no surprise that these algorithms end up targeting the same groups. It's, you know, I think with the NYPD, it's worth looking in a bit more detail at some of the actual things that were happening on the ground. So there was a kid called Shamil Rahman, who was a 19-year-old student who was arrested with a small amount of marijuana a few years ago, happens to be Muslim. So the NYPD say, okay, we're going to drop the charges if you work as an informant for us, right? So this kid was tasked over a couple of years with basically sitting in all the meetings of the Muslim student associations in City University, New York, joining the other students on their trips out of town, and basically writing down everything that anyone said. You know, someone says something about U.S. foreign policy, that gets written down, right? And this kid then eventually went to the press with his story because he basically said, look, this is wrong, right? I'm not collecting anything about any actual terrorism here. This is something very different. And that part of the program, there's been no, you know, the running of informants and including entrapments, right? There's a kind of thin line between running informants and then using those informants to entrap people into crimes that they wouldn't otherwise commit. That has not been dismantled at all. We've had no announcement from New York City Council about that part of the program.
Now, we do know that the FBI, Trevor Aronson, did a whole book based on an article in Mother Jones, the Inside the Terror Factory, and basically half of the plots that the FBI has thwarted, they had previously been involved in erecting. Your term entrapment is quite fitting.
Yeah, I mean, the FBI has 15,000 paid informants across the United States. We don't know how many of those are specifically working on Muslim Americans, but it's reasonable to assume, you know, half of those probably are. We know that a substantial number of the actual terrorist plots that have gone to court in the United States are the result of an informant getting in someone's life and basically spending a year or two putting psychological pressures on that person to get them to be involved in some kind of made-up plot that was never going to happen if it wasn't for the FBI's invention, right? So the FBI is kind of, to a large degree, fantasizing into existence the very threat of terrorism that it goes to Congress every year to get, you know, millions of dollars of money for, right? It's a nice little gravy train. There's a verdict that came out yesterday on a case that that I've been working on of an African-American Muslim guy in Springfield, Massachusetts, called Ayub Abdul Alim, who was put under pressure for several years to become a paid informant with the FBI. That went against his principles, so he refused to do it. Eventually, he was framed on gun possession charges And one of the things we found out was that actually the FBI had recruited a woman who then got married to this guy as part of their intent to entrap him, right? So we have a situation now where the FBI is kind of running a kind of marriage agency as part of its
dating,
entrapment operations.
Dating game. It's Match.com all over again. And,
right.
And the COINTELPRO jobs program. I don't think Americans expected Obama to have that kind of jobs program.
Right, absolutely. You know, a lot of activists call this COINTELPRO 2.0, right? A continuation of the Hoover era FBI.
Deepa, you wanted to chime in here?
I thought you needed to.
Oh, okay. Well, we can. Yeah, we're going to wind down in this segment of the program. We're going to have a Project Censored Validated Independent News segment coming up here in a moment. But I wanted to remind people that you are listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm joined by Dr. Deepa Kumar, who's a professor of media studies and Middle Eastern studies at Rutgers University. Also joined by Dr. Arun Kundnani, author most recently of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. So up next, we have a validated independent news story. Our associate director, Andy Lee Roth, who helped put this show together today with Deepa and Arun, much thanks to him, has also been working with Project Censored students at researching stories and then summarizing them, vetting them. And these are stories that become in the running for our next book cycle. And we're working on Censored 2015 right now and doing the balloting of that. But here is a recent validated independent news story from College of Marin and Professor Susan Rahman.
For Project Censored, I'm Alexandria McDowell with today's validated independent news story. There is new evidence that is casting doubt on the Syrian government's responsibility for the attack just outside of Damascus on the 21st of August 2013. This attack involved a sarin gas raid, killing its own men, women, and children. However, the Syrian government may not have been responsible for the nerve agent attack that left hundreds of Syrians dead, contrary to what the Obama administration has claimed. Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh and others have reported that U.S. intelligence deliberately manipulated its findings to justify a subsequent strike against Assad, whose regime is being blamed for the attack. In a report assessing possible implications of faulty U.S. intelligence, Richard Lloyd, a former U.N. weapons inspector, and Theodore Pistol, a professor at MIT, examined the delivery rocket's design and calculated possible trajectories based on the rocket's payload. The area shown in the intelligence map published by the White House on August 30, 2013, claims that the rocket could not have been fired from the heart or the eastern edge of the city of which the Syrian government has control. Based on mathematical calculations, Lloyd and Pistol estimate the rocket with such aerodynamics could not travel more than 2 kilometers. Based on a firing range and troop locations on August 21st, these authors concluded that all possible launching points within the 2 kilometer radius were in rebel-held areas. This raises questions about the internal conflict that is happening among the rebels. The tactics are extreme, and the story of this deadly civil war continues to unfold, and lately there seems to be more questions than answers. This has been Alexandria McDowell with Project Censored. This underreported news story was researched by Eddie Correll from Sonoma State University and evaluated by Marco Gonzalez with College of Marin and Peter Phillips with Sonoma State University as part of Project Censored's Validated Independent News Program. For more validated independent news stories, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link for validated news.
Secretive government had a secret operation, massacring villages, killing millions, secretly bombing an entire nation. They wiretapped a hotel room. They got caught and the government was deposed because of secret documents Daniel Ellsberg exposed. One government came down, and to prevent a repetition of this fact, the next government passed the Freedom of Information Act. Each administration since then hoped it would go away, and then they finally seized the chance on a September day. They passed the Patriot Act before a single congressman had read it, but don't ask the executive how they interpret it. because that itself is secret, never to be revealed, just like their secret prisons and all the torture sessions they concealed. Then they formed the prison program so they wouldn't even have to ask compliant corporations to assist them in the task of collecting information. Every email you ever wrote, every book you ever read, every call you ever made, everything you ever said. I looked into a prism, what did I see? A police state looking back at me. The secret government men lied to congressional committees. Secret information even a senator can't see. Secret bureaucrats working with secret corporations, enforcing secret laws, forming secret juries to serve a secret cause. I looked into a prism, what did I see? A police state looking back at me. One brave man came forward and then he fled town. And now the secret government men mean to hunt him down. Feinstein says he's a traitor. McConnell said so too. But I'd say if we have a future, it's because of the whistle that he blew. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. That was the music of David Rovix from the album If I Had a Hammer. The song was called Prism, an apt song for today's discussion. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Deepa Kumar, Associate Professor of Media Studies, Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University. And we're talking about Islamophobia. Her recent book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. We're joined also by Dr. Arun Kundnani, who writes about race and Islamophobia. His newest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. That's out by Verso Books. Deepa, your book is out by Haymarket Books. And we're continuing our discussion about Islamophobia, media slanting and propaganda and so forth. And probably another good place to just start back with that in this segment of the program, since we have you both for the full hour today, which we're lucky to have. The way that the corporate media tend to frame these issues obviously reflects the dominant narratives, reflects, as we said in the first segment, reflects the historical racism and so forth. Couldn't help but think, Deepa Kumar, when you were talking about the framing of the other and Arabs as the enemy, the documentary film Real Bad Arabs. Folks unfamiliar with that should certainly check out that film, R-E-E-L, Real Bad Arabs. But, you know, how is the corporate media slanting say the surveillance cases with the NYPD, and also we want to get into some issues with drone strikes as well. But Deepa, let's start with you. Let's talk a little bit more about corporate framing and slanting and propaganda regarding these issues.
Right. I'll let Arun talk about surveillance in the media. I'll just say that after the Edward Snowden leaks, surveillance has become now a household issue. Everyone talks about it. But it's a problem only to the extent that ordinary people, i.e. Reed white Americans, are now being surveilled. And the issue wasn't problematic when it was, you know, the suspect population.
Like Dianne Feinstein, all of a sudden
right. It's
a big problem.
That's right. It's been called the Angela Merkel effect, which is when people in positions of power realize that their phones are being tapped, all of a sudden it's a problem. But I think what's missing is, of course, the systematic surveillance of Muslim Americans, which has been going on quite unchecked and unreported by the news media. But I'll say a little bit also about the sort of spectacles of entrapment, right? So one of the ways in which to keep fear alive in the American imagination is to have these so-called foiled terror plots, usually instigated by the FBI, then become headline news, then become the thing that people watch as they're eating dinner. One such example would be the Newburgh Four. These are four African-American men, vulnerable, poor, some of them having sort of mental issues and so forth. They get entrapped by this agent provocateur to carrying out an attack on a mosque in the Bronx. I'm sorry, a synagogue in the Bronx. And of course, all of the bombs and the equipment and so on are provided by this agent provocateur. One of the people actually, while they're going to go through with this, develops doubts and says, you know, I don't want to do this. I don't want to kill children and women and so on. And the agent, of course, says, no, you have to do this and so forth. And then he's driving them to this synagogue. And all of a sudden, of course, here come the NYPD and they have nabbed them. And just coincidentally, there's a police helicopter with a television camera there to capture the whole thing. So these sorts of spectacles get produced again and again, very consciously by the mainstream media to create an atmosphere of fear and, you know, a threat consciousness that then, you know, enables us to give consent to the growth of this massive surveillance state and national security state.
Well, Deepa Kumar, you just described a clear collusion between state actors and the corporate news media, creating a for spectacle image to project an image to the public, that which they've already been stoking, this fear. The government then is actively involved in creating these types of scenarios. And as you said, the news media is conveniently just there in the police helicopter to catch it all for the nightly news. Just reminded me, one of the local TV news stations here, KTVU, I would not say it's a subtle framing, but apparently others seem to see it that way, or it's normalized, or people aren't paying enough attention, I guess. But the evening news just yesterday, they have the scenes of black-on-black crime and violence in communities of color, and then they go over to Eastern Europe and Russia and how that's all devolving, and it's these people can't seem to govern their own affairs. And then without skipping a beat, they segue to Chelsea Clinton's pregnancy and the great Clinton dynasties. I mean, these are some of the words that were used, dynasties, and then Hillary might be the first grandma running for president kind of thing. And the contrast of the coverage of the area of the demographics on it, so starkly obvious, and that framing in the corporate media, it's just mystifying to me, really, that more people aren't picking up on it or noticing it, or if they are, they feel maybe just outside the realm of where do we communicate it. Deepa, you just were in the New York Times the other day, which is a great breakthrough, because it's not all the time you get to see some of those arguments in the New York Times.
Absolutely. As you were talking, it made me think that this is what empires look like, isn't it? They have a system of policing and control of all sorts of dissent and a celebration of, you know, dynasties and rulers. So in so many ways, this is we're living in the heart of an empire, even in these superficial kinds of ways. But Arun, can you speak a little bit more about the coverage of surveillance and how the media have treated this issue?
I think the general point here is, under the Bush years, we had a kind of a debate going on about the war on terror, right? It was a kind of odd debate at times. It's weird for a country to debate whether or not it's a good idea to torture people. But there was a debate around the war on terror between liberals and conservatives. Obama comes to office and basically that debate gets shut down, right? And I think that's the kind of picture here. Mainstream journalists basically stopped asking questions about the war on terror. Once Obama was in office, basically everyone thought this is now a dead issue. And meanwhile, the war on terror continued pretty much the same as it did under the last few years of the Bush years. So then within that climate, you literally have a handful of journalists in the mainstream media in the United States who've been able to pick up on some of the some of the issues around the war on terror: Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras. But that's it, pretty much, right? The rest of the mainstream media looks like it's totally complicit. And you can read the New York Times, a supposedly liberal, balanced newspaper. All of its coverage of counterterrorism, the war on terror, all of their sources are government sources. They're not going to anyone else to get any information. They're not doing any investigative journalism. So the drone strike program, for example, which has been going on intensely under Obama, much more so than under Bush, you won't find any information about the real impact of what that means in Somalia or Yemen or Pakistan from any of the mainstream media.
You know, at Project Censor for a long time, we've abandoned the use of the term mainstream media because it's part of the corporate plutocratic propaganda campaign to convince people that corporate media is the mainstream and those are mainstream views. So we usually say corporate media as a more descriptive potential terminology for that. And it's interesting, the folks that you mentioned, all intrepid independent journalists, who I would agree are part of the should be part of the mainstream dialogue and debate. However, Scahill maybe does Democracy Now. His film did get nominated for an Oscar, which was a miraculous feat there. Dirty Wars. Greenwald was writing for The Guardian, though. That's in London, and now The Intercept. So those characters don't always get, they don't get a platform.
Absolutely.
I was just lauding Deepa for getting into the New York Times the other day. And to their credit, they had you there. But to their credit, they did win a Pulitzer over the Moss Crawl story.
Right.
And AP has broken some stories. But again, these are like sort of just gems in piles of rubble, really, because that's not the norm there.
Well, and absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you know, the Associated Press story on the NYPD surveillance was an important story. But it's very interesting the silences around it. So, for example, the FBI is doing exactly the same stuff as the NYPD, but that has never been reported. The two journalists who did the AP story actually wrote a book on the back of the story where the FBI get kind of glorified and celebrated as the right way to do counterterrorism, right? So even though the FBI are doing all the same kinds of things around entrapments and surveillance, they get a free ride from the same journalists. So, you know, absolutely, there's a huge problem there. You know, I think for me, the most shocking example I've seen recently of this kind of stuff is the kind of stuff you see in the New York Times around these kind of glorifications of Obama in the decision mode of like whether to do a kill strike through drones, right? So it was an incredible piece in the New York Times not that long ago describing Obama like this kind of thoughtful, really moral. A quandary kind of moment that he has where he has to decide whether or not to do an extrajudicial killing of someone on the other side of the world, right? And then John Brennan, the head of the CIA, is sitting there with him. Supposedly they're discussing, you know, philosophy and just war theory as they're about to give the order to kill someone, right? And so the kind of way in which this kind of assassination policy, just the fact that we have this phrase, the kill list, right? Gets presented in the New York Times as this kind of wonderful moment of philosophy, right? It's bizarre.
It's totally bizarre. I mean, it's riveting, and it's such a distortion of values and the way that the establishment news media frames it, it somehow tries to legitimize it. And the amazing thing is that it seems to go over among some parts of the population.
In fact, if you attack it, if you are a critical journalist like Jeremy Scahill or like Glenn Greenwald, then there is a witch hunt mentality to actually put you down. So for instance, Glenn Greenwald's entire life was taken apart because he had the audacity to actually bring to light the Snowden revelations. And in fact, they were referred to rather than as whistleblowers and as, courageous independent journalists, terms like terrorists were used in reference to people like Snowden and Greenwald and all the rest of it. So there is a lot of pressure to not question the elite and their priorities. In fact, the NJ lawsuit against the NYPD program, one of the reasons that the judge gave to throw it out is he said, this spying program has had absolutely no impact on the people who are being spied until the Associated Press actually ran the story. So it's the Associated Press that's really to blame here.
We certainly know how to play shoot the messenger here
in
the U.S., and that's definitely a problematic dynamic. And in fact, Glenn Greenwald just came back to the United States to receive the prestigious Polk Award, one of the highest awards in journalism, while fearing that he would be arrested at the airport. The Department of Justice, sick, not saying whether or not they were going to arrest him. And then representatives like Peter King literally saying that Greenwald's a disgrace to journalism and to the country and so on. I mean, again, it's bizarro world, up is down, black is white. It's a very depressing thing in parts to watch, but the heartening thing is that there are people like you, Deepa Kumar, Arun Kundnani, there are a lot of other journalists and scholars writing about these issues, trying to do something about these issues. Certainly that's what we're trying to do here today. Deepa, you just wrote another article, been busy lately, for The Progressive, Judicial Ruling Disasters for Americans, and this is a different judicial ruling, and we go back to the issue of drones, drone warfare, and drone strikes, something certainly we've covered at Project Censored over the years, but also one of those issues that it went from obscurity to it wasn't happening to ignoring it to somehow it just got mainstreamed as a way of saving lives, you know, more Orwellian doublespeak. Deepa, can you talk to us about that issue in the ruling?
Certainly. In 2011, three American citizens, Anwar al-Awlaki, his 16-year-old son, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, and Samir Khan, were actually killed without due process, without any evidence being presented in court, in two drone strikes. The first drone strike took out the older al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, and then 2 weeks later, the 16-year-old is sitting having a meal, I think, and here comes this drone strike. And he's assassinated.
Who grew up in Colorado?
Yes, that's right. American-born, grew up in the city, and featured actually in Dirty Wars, the movie, Jeremy Scahill's movie. So people should see that movie. I mean, this is a wonderful child. So the family brought a lawsuit to try to seek justice for the people who were killed. And recently, a judge threw that case out too, basically saying, you know, she gave a long explanation, but part of that explanation is that we should apparently trust our policymakers when they carry out drone strikes, because if they, you know, get their directions from the president, we should trust that they're acting in line with the U.S. Constitution. So there you have it. You know, without as much as a day in court, the ultimate punishment gets meted out. Arun, you've written about this in your book. Could you say a little bit about the leaked memo, the Obama memo that justifies this kind of extrajudicial killing, and what else could have been done in this case?
Right. Well, so the kind of supposed legal basis for the drone program is the authorization for the use of military force that was passed almost unanimously by Congress a couple of weeks after 9/11, which basically defines the whole world as a battlefield, right? And says, as far as the war on terror is concerned, you can use military force in any context around the world, including within the United States, in fact. And so Anwar al-Awlaki, who's the case that legal document from the Department of Justice focuses on, was killed on that basis. But in principle, it means that the administration can decide unilaterally that it will kill anyone without any kind of requirement that there's an actual battlefield taking place or that there's any kind of crime involved. Al-Awlaki was a propagandist, right? He was someone who produced online material supporting Al-Qaeda, right? But he was not involved in any kind of imminent threat, right, which is the normal definition even in a war situation. And so what's happened is the US government has killed someone for what they're saying, not for what they're doing, which is absolutely shocking. Another kind of small point on the back of that, which I think is important and very few people talk about, is we now have a situation where a number of people who are British citizens have been killed in drone strikes as well, right? But we don't hear about that. Why? Because the UK government has introduced a policy whereby when the US government wants to kill a British citizen in a drone strike, it can strip that person of their citizenship, right? So unlike al-Awlaki,
where,
you know, al-Awlaki, there is some kind of reporting that says the US government has just killed an American citizen in a drone strike. But with the British citizens, you never see that reporting because technically, at the point of their death, they were no longer British citizens. They were stateless.
Yeah, right? Talk about censorship of not just the idea, it's just wiping out the entire value, the entire notion.
Of being a
human being.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a kind of fascist dream that you can strip the citizenship of someone who's a fellow citizen of yours based on, effectively, because they're brown, right?
Well, speaking of fascist dreams or nightmares, one of the proponents and architects of the Bush War on Terror was Condoleezza Rice. And Condoleezza Rice is now being tapped as a speaker to come to Minnesota, New Jersey, and in fact was invited to be a commencement speaker where you teach, Deepa, at Rutgers University. And I know you wanted to say a few things about that. We have a few minutes left in the program, but I wanted to tie over to that and how our culture and how our institutions have so normalized these things we've been talking about today that somehow these people can be lauded as great leaders and so forth. I mean, frankly, it is quite shocking.
Yes. I mean, let's be clear. Even though Dianne Feinstein's Senate Intelligence Committee is going to be releasing a 400-page summary report on torture during the Bush era, the Obama administration has actually exonerated everyone involved with the torture regime. Not one person has been held accountable. It's kind of ironic that Arun and I are going to be speaking at the Bolt Law School, which is the home of John Woo, one of the architects of this process. But about Rutgers honoring Condoleezza Rice, we are giving her a Doctor of Laws degree for violating the Geneva Convention. But, you know, there you have it. And she's going to be commencement speaker. And, of course, none of us were involved in consulting. Standard practice at Rutgers is that a team of about 20 or so faculty and students get together. They canvass the population at Rutgers to see who would be a good speaker. But our current president, who came in 2012, decided to violate this procedure, had a secret group of six people, including himself, on this committee. And we believe actually that this selection came from Governor Christie. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, this was before Bridgegate and all the scandals, but at the time he was potentially going to run for president. And the word is that he's going to tap Condoleezza Rice to be his running mate. And therefore, what better way than to have, you know, the State University of New Jersey, Rutgers, actually honor her in this fashion. So we've actually been fighting back. This has been a moment where we have actually been able to educate people on the war on terror, on the lies leading up to the Iraq war that Condoleezza Rice was complicit with, and so on. So it's been an educational moment. It's also been a moment for activism. And we hope, if not to disinvite her, to at least, create greater awareness around this. And the last thing I'll say about this is that Brandeis University, by taking away the honorary degree that they were going to give to a notorious Islamophobe, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who's considered a quote-unquote feminist, in fact, she's not, I think the activism at that campus is really inspiring to us at Rutgers.
Certainly something, like you said, to raise awareness around, even though you have been shut out of the selection process. But that's something that we really need to push into the, sounds strange, push back into the university element, the notion of dialogue and debate and discourse and transparency. Arun Kundani, we only have about a minute or two left, but I wanted to toss it over here to you and just have your last thoughts on maybe the Rutgers case, Condi Rice, and
right.
What
I mean,
you think about?
I teach a class on terrorism at City University of New York, and in the last year or so, someone else who's teaching about terrorism in the same place is David Petraeus, right? The war criminal from the military and from the CIA, right? So if you're a war criminal, it seems like a good place to retire on a cushy job is our universities. You know, I mean, he's certainly getting paid literally around 30 times what I get paid, right? So, what I would say is, I think the really important thing around all of these discussions around surveillance and fear is the aim of surveillance is to stop us talking because we get scared that someone's listening and that we should just stay silent, right? And actually, that's the worst thing that can happen here. We need to keep talking about these issues. We need to not allow that fear to prevent us from saying what we want to say politically, right? And I think that's a really important way of responding to all these discussions about the NSA and so forth.
Absolutely, and that's certainly what we've been doing here today with Dr. Arun Kundani, also Dr. Deepa Kumar. Arun, could you give a website?
Yeah, it's kundanani.org. Which is kundanai.org.
And Deepa?
It's deepakumar.net, deepakumar.net.
I'd like to thank both Deepa and Arun for being guests on the Project Censored show here today as we talked about Islamophobia, the politics of empire from national insecurity to state drone wars and beyond in the 21st century. I would like to thank everyone for being here again today listening to us. Thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. Thanks to Kirsten Thomas on the controls. And also like to remind you, you are listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. You can find us online at projectcensored.org. Follow us on Facebook. See you next time.